And now for reading and writing and radio.
We are now in the course of our history approaching times pregnant with events wonderful in their causes, operations, and effects. Times to which there is no parallel in the history of the world, events in which we behold a nation consisting at first of 12 young men, becoming at length a nation the greatest, the most powerful, most warlike, and most magnificent in the whole world, a nation before whom Persia, Greece, Rome, and England must hide their diminished heads, and to which the whole world pays homage and is subject to.
That noble passage was written about 160 years ago by Branwell Bronte, age 13, chronicling the history of his 12 wooden soldiers. But you can imagine histories for your playthings, too.
WSSR Radio at Sangamon State University presents Reading and Writing and Radio, a program about creative writing. Your host is Jacqueline Jackson, children's author and professor of literature at Sangamon State University.
Let me tell you about a family, three sisters and a brother. The girls' names were Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, and the boys, Branwell. Their last name was Bronte. Their father was a clergyman, and they lived in a little village in the north of England over 160 years ago. Their mother was dead, and they had two older sisters who also died when the sisters were about 10 and 11. And this very much affected the four children that I'm telling you about. For the father had sent the two oldest girls and Charlotte and Emily away to school, a boarding school, which is a school where you live, where you eat and sleep, even on weekends, and only go home occasionally for holidays, that is, if you live close enough. This was a cold school, and I mean really cold. There wasn't any heat. Except, of course, fireplaces, and it can get very cold in Yorkshire in England. Think of living in a house where you have to break the ice on the wash basin in order to wash your face in the morning. They didn't really have proper clothing. There were no warm, waterproof winter boots like we have, no down or dacron jackets. The children on Sundays at this school had to walk two by two across the moors. Those are treeless fields of heather. To church that was several miles away, and in the cutting wind and in the rain, for it usually rained, with their feet in thin little shoes, they would be soaked from head to toe, their clothing soaked, their shoes soaked. They'd sit in an icy church for a long service and then have some sort of cold lunch and then go to church again all afternoon, drafty, I'm sure, and then walk home still in the wet and in the sleet and the wind. No wonder that the two older Bronte girls became ill and were sent home to die. It's a wonder that Charlotte and Emily survived. Perhaps those two girls died of pneumonia, a lung infection, but it could have been a flu, and the girls would have been susceptible, being in a weakened condition from colds and so forth, probably poor nutrition, too. Their deaths could have been complicated by tuberculosis, which is a more slow-killing lung disease which afflicted the family later. And could have at that point. Anyway, the girls died within a week or two of each other at the age of most of you who are listening to Reading and Writing and Radio. And Papa Bronte rushed to the school and brought home his other two daughters, Charlotte and Emily, so that they would not die too. And how lucky we are that those two younger girls were saved, for a while at least, for when they weren't very old. They each published a book, and those two books are two of the most famous books in the English language, Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights. And in Jane Eyre, in the early chapters, you can read about the school that Charlotte and Emily were snatched away from, and there is probably very little poetic license in the telling. Now, that's a term that I learned from my mother when I was about your age. Poetic license means liberty in the telling. As a writer, you're allowed to stretch the facts, to make things up, to tell it as you'd like it to be or as you'd think it would be more dramatic, rather than as it really was. I always say never spoil a good story for the facts. And you can do that writing fiction. You shouldn't do it for history or biography or something that you're saying is actually the way it happened. But in this case, Charlotte probably told about Lowood, the school, as she calls the school, pretty accurately, using very little poetic license. It was really a pretty dreadful place for little girls. Teachers, why don't you get a copy of Jane Eyre and read to your class that first gripping school chapter, or two or three? When Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights were published, Charlotte and Emily used men's names. They made up names for themselves, for it wasn't easy for women to be published. Then when the books were bestsellers and Charlotte and Emily's identities became known, then people were amazed, first, that such powerful books were written by women, and second, that they were written by such young women. How could a young woman suddenly produce a masterpiece? They also thought, you know, up there in Yorkshire, how could somebody living in that little village in Yorkshire? But for such a young woman to produce a masterpiece, and two of them, it was like having a baby without being pregnant, or like birthing an adult, like the father of the gods Jove did, his daughter Athena, Wisdom, who burst full-grown right out of his forehead. But I'm getting ahead of my story. Charlotte and Emily came home, and their brother Branwell was there, and Anne the youngest. And besides the sadness at losing their sisters and earlier having lost their mother, they were affected in this way, that they were home, the four of them together, and isolated. They didn't go to school. They did their lessons at home. They had their mother's aunt there, Aunt Branwell, and she oversaw them and saw that they did their lessons and their sewing and all their chores. She wasn't a particularly affectionate mother type, and Pa Bronte was usually in his study writing sermons and studying and so forth. And so the four were alone, without much direct adult input, and of course no radio, no TV, no entertainment other than books. And I'm sure there was also a regular newspaper, and they also got Blackwood's Magazine, which had articles and stories and things like that. Apparently, they seldom or never played with neighborhood kids. We have no indication of other children coming or going into the house at all. And they lived in a very small village, a factory and a mill village. So what did the four of them do for entertainment? For sure, to their stone and stone-cold parsonage with the wind wuthering over the moors outside. I'll tell you. They lived in their heads. They made up stories, and they lived those stories. They nourished themselves on their imagination. There may have been earlier play and stories, probably there were, but the play took on a definite form after Pa Bronte came back from a visit to the large town of Leeds with presents for all the four children. And the best present, it turned out, was for Branwell, who was then 9 years old, a box of 12 hand-carved wooden soldiers. Let me read from someone's account. The children were asleep for the night, and the soldiers were placed where Branwell's eyes lighted upon them when he awoke in the morning. Catching them up, he ran to his sister's room, calling them to come and see his treasures. Out of bed they sprang, Charlotte in the lead. Snatching up the best looking of the lot, she claimed it for her own, calling it the Duke of Wellington. Emily likewise took up one and said it should be hers, and Anne, following their example, made her choice. Branwell, like a polite little gentleman, made his choice last, calling his soldier Bonaparte, as Napoleon. He was careful that his sisters should understand that he was merely lending the toys to them, though he later gave each her particular soldier for her own. The wooden soldiers became the heroes of countless games. Their names varied amusingly with the adventure in hand. Sometimes they were drawn from the children's reading of politics and history, Arthur Wellesley, Ferdinand Cortez, Sometimes they indicated the moral characteristics of their bearers, goody, baddie, naughty, bravey, sneaky, gravy, and rogue. And sometimes they suggested the ligneous, that means made out of wood, nature of their toys. Captain Tree, Sergeant Bud, General Leaf, Major Arbor, and Colonel Branch. Collectively, the toys were the young men, or the 12s, to distinguish them from fragments of sets that remained from former days. The children, taking a suggestion from the Arabian Nights, constituted themselves the guardian genie of the young men, like the genies out of a bottle, you know. The chief genius Tally, that was Charlotte, chief genius Branny, chief genius Emmy, and chief genius Annie, they called themselves, and they were the guardian angels, the genie, that looked after the 12, sort of the heavenly figures, the big ones that played with them, but it was more than that. They were real, the soldiers were real, and these were those that were guiding them. The four of them played with these soldiers over the months and the years, and as they did so, the soldiers developed, besides names, personalities and histories and stories. They even lived in countries, imaginary lands that the four made up, with rulers and political intrigues and disasters and invasions and explorations and subduing the natives, as conquering countries have always done. And the four kids began to write down these histories, the stories, and to make maps of the lands and to write little magazines of the day for the 12s. Actually, there came to be two lands, because the four started writing together, but after a while they split into pairs. It's not easy enough to collaborate with two people, but with four it must have been quite difficult. Branwell and Charlotte concentrated on a country that they called Angria, and Emily and Anne imagined and wrote about a country called Gondal. Most of the chronicles of Gondal have been lost, only various poems, poetry cycles about the stories remain, and here and there references in other places to Gondal, so that we know that it existed and that it occupied Anne and Emily for a long time. But a whole lot of Angria has been preserved in little books that the children stitched together with elaborate title pages and printed in teensy-weensy print, so tight and so small you can hardly read it. For, of course, the books were supposed to be for the soldiers and therefore had to be small. How small? Well, look at the palm of your hand and figure a book of 10 or 12 or 16 pages that would lie easily on the palm of your hand, about 1.5 inches by 1.25 inches, that small. Now, the subject matter of these stories doesn't sound much like children's books or that children would be interested in writing. They're about adults doing adult things, wars, politics, conquests, love affairs. But you have to remember two things. First, these all were based on soldiers. They'd begun as stories about soldiers, and soldiers are adults who wouldn't have children's concerns. But more important, the Brontë children had nothing but adult models. There weren't any children's books, or scarcely any, in the 1820s, not certainly like you have today. They probably had some fairy and folk tales books, either or else had heard these stories, but fairy and folk tales weren't the province necessarily of children. Adults enjoyed them too. And we know too, on account of the genie, that they did have a knowledge of Arabian Nights. But the kind of books that they learned from in school and at home were the Bible, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, Aesop's Fables, adult sermons, histories, geographies, adult fiction, such as Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, all books mainly concerned with adult activities and behaviors. Also, children at that time were themselves considered small adults with the same concerns as adults, only on a childish scale of understanding. So naturally, Charlotte and Emily and Anne and Branwell wrote of adult subjects. Charlotte's soldier, the Duke of Wellington, was the British war hero who had defeated Napoleon, the French conqueror, and by the time Charlotte was growing up, a number of years later, had achieved the status of a god or a myth in England. But the names sometimes betrayed the children were writing the books. You've heard me list some of them earlier. I didn't find one in this place called Bravey, or did we? Another was Sneaky, but I guess they didn't mention the one that fell in the butter and was named Butter Crashy. Apparently it was summer, for the butter was soft, or else it was near to the stove, and I do think the one named Gravy wasn't named because he fell in the gravy, but because he was a grave and solemn sort of fellow. Also, they tend toward sensational subject matter. For instance, medical schools were just coming into being and dissecting cadavers, and graves were being robbed for this new science. And so one of the heroes, one of the soldiers, narrowly escaped in one of their stories being dissected alive. Well, rather than to read you a part of the swashbuckling adventures of the books, I want to read you a little bit of how Charlotte felt about the books, about the worlds that she and her siblings were creating, for it speaks to the power of writing and the imagination. Now, these books and these all this play was very, very secret. Pa Bronte and Aunt Branwell had no idea what the kids were up to, even though they were crowded together in a small house. They did know they were writing things that had very small print, and they told them not to and worried about their eyes. They didn't know. And when Charlotte went away to school again and then came home for 3 years and wrote like mad, and a friend of hers wrote her and said, "What do you do all day?" Charlotte didn't give a hint of the play world that colored all her thoughts. And she wrote at the time that she was most absorbed. Let's see if I can find it here. "An account of one day," she writes to her friend, "is an account of all. In the morning, from 9 o'clock till 12:30, I instruct my sisters and draw. Then we walk out till dinner time. After dinner, I sew till tea time, and after tea, I either write, read, do a little fancy work, or draw as I please. Thus, in one delightful, though somewhat monotonous course, my life is passed." And even when she was famous and was being having her biography written by a woman named Mrs. Gaskell, she didn't tell Mrs. Gaskell what it was all about and all this that she was doing and her brothers and sisters and their imagination. And Mrs. Gaskell entitled the chapters about being at Haworth something about the dreary years at Haworth. And for those children, those years were not dreary. Here is Charlotte talking, thinking back about the excitement of their imaginations back there at Haworth when she is off teaching at school as a very young adult, probably 17, 18. "Once more on a dull Saturday afternoon, I sit down to try to summon around me the dim shadows of incidents long departed, of feelings, of pleasures whose exquisite relish I sometimes fear will never be my lot again to taste. How few would believe that from sources purely imaginary such happiness could be derived. Pen cannot portray the deep interest of the scenes of the continued train of events I have witnessed in that little room with the low, narrow bed and bare, whitewashed walls 20 miles away. There have I sat on the low bedstead, my eye fixed on the window, through which appeared no other landscape than a monotonous stretch of moorland, a gray church tower rising from the center of a churchyard so filled with graves that the rank weeds and coarse grass scarce had room to shoot up between the monuments. Such was the picture that threw its reflections upon my eye, but communicated no impression to my heart. A long tale was perhaps then evolving itself in my mind, the history of an ancient and aristocratic family, young lords and ladies, dazzled with the brilliancy of courts, happy with the ambition of senates. As I saw them stately and handsome, gliding through those salons where many well-known forms crossed my sight, where there were faces looking up, eyes smiling, and lips moving in audible speech, that I knew better almost than my brother and sisters, yet whose voices had never woke an echo in this world. What glorious associations crowded upon me! Far from home I cannot write of them, except in total solitude I dare not them." And this was a great sadness to her, because she was longing to be lost in her imagination, but she wouldn't be able to because she was teaching school. I can give you many more of those passages, but our time is getting short, and so I will finish telling you about these Bronte children. Charlotte wrote 4 good-sized novels when she was an adult, the best known being Jane Eyre. If you take all of her writings as a child, all those little books, everything that's survived, and there were 4 writing years from which nothing has survived, and so we don't know how much there was then, and if you count the words, She wrote more words in her childish writings than in all her adult years, all her adult writings, her four novels. So we can also believe, did Emily and Anne, though they didn't have as long to write as adults as Charlotte did. For the Brontes had a terrible year of death. In the fall of 1848, when Branwell was 30, and had been turning the Bronte home into a horror with his alcoholic ravings and destruction, he died, not only of alcoholism, but of tuberculosis, the wasting disease of the lungs called consumption because it slowly consumed its victims. A couple of months later, Emily, age 29, died, also of tuberculosis. She never admitted to being ill. I think her illness wasn't even recognized by the other until after Branwell was gone. Every day she got up, got dressed, sat, probably reclined toward the end, on a sofa, defiant of death, until it took her before Christmas. And she never knew that the book that she had just published, Wuthering Heights, would be acclaimed as a masterpiece and still be being read today. In January, right after Christmas, Anne realized that she too was ill and would die of consumption. There's a heart-rending poem that I have seen in Anne's handwriting, written the day that she discovered this, a poem expressing her terrors and anguish at not wanting to die at the age of 28. But die she did that spring, and that left only grief-stricken Charlotte and her father. I should mention that Anne had had a book published, too. It's not as famous as the other two, but it's a very good book. Well, Charlotte and Emily soon became famous for their two books, and Charlotte went on to write more. She also received several proposals of marriage. She finally married, against her father's will, his assistant, his curate, named Arthur Bell Nichols, and we think that she had some happiness in that marriage, though that she wrote to a friend that being a housewife no longer gave her any time to write. But her happiness was cut short because before she'd been married a year, she died of complications of pregnancy, perhaps also aggravated by tuberculosis, for she certainly carried the TB virus, and it can lie dormant until conditions are right. She was only 39. So that's the end of my story about four remarkable children. Except for Shakespeare's Stratford-on-Avon, there's no literary spot in the world more visited than the Bronte Parsonage in Yorkshire, England. And our England class and some of your teachers visited there, and it was a thrill to see those little rooms and the writings on the wall that they had done, the clothes, the shoes they wore, and the little books, the remarkable little books about Angria and the Gondel poems that those children wrote. We saw their tombstones in the church, and we walked out on the moors, and we were moved. So what's my message to you kids today? That Charlotte, Emily, and Anne didn't produce masterpieces just out of the blue. They'd been writing constantly since they were little kids. Their childhood writing was valuable in itself, as writing and beyond it as a source of joy and satisfaction to them, and it was also valuable as a training ground for their later works. I maintain it would have been valuable no matter what they'd become, and if they'd lived longer. For to be comfortable with the written word and to use your imagination will make you better in whatever you do, and it will also open doors to more interesting future opportunities for you. So my message is, live in your heads, exercise your imaginations, daydream, and don't just do it with TV, which stimulates some, but it drains even more. So be bored, give yourself time, imagine, so that you'll not be constantly entertained from outside, but you'll have to invent out of your own head. And as for your writing today, why not look at your toys? Have you ever used them in imaginative play? Tell me about it. Or write an adventure using a toy that's especially alive to you, or more than one toy. You may want to make a tiny book like the Brontes did. If so, send me the story, but save your book, for tiny books should be saved for children and grandchildren and literary biographers. In the manual, I mention a book called The Return of the Twelves by Pauline Clark, which is a book about the 12 soldiers being found again in modern times and coming to life, and I suggest that you read it. You'd probably enjoy it, although it's a little bit slow. What I really suggest is to spend more time on the Brontes themselves and on your own imaginative writing.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.